Holman.
Aber du kannst ja dann so im Hintergrund so.
You know the joke with the K-Flex? K-Flex a movie? Guy is a crazy guy. He says that I'm always crazy.
Oh, sorry, tell you the joke later. Welcome on stage 5. Master and servants. No, not Deepesh Mode, but the question, when we thought of robots and computers, I think most of the people thought of that they're going to be servants and supporters. But recently, the question came up, what happens when an algorithm is telling you what to work and how to work? And the two doctors I'm going to introduce soon, Leo Salmanson and Thomas Gegenhuber, welcome on stage. I'm going to tell you a little bit more about you in a second. Lior, Thomas. And they are researching in the area about the question, what happens when algorithm is becoming your boss? For example, with Uber or Amazon, the platform Mechanical Turk. And that will be the subject of your two presentations. But before, a little bit more about you. Lior is a lecturer and writer and researcher, and he was a Fulbright scholar in New York, and also he was fellow of the Metropolitan Museum Media Lab, also in New York, and he founded in his hometown. It's your hometown. You're coming from Haifa, right?
No, I'm from Tel Aviv.
Ah, you're from Tel Aviv. You told me already. I forgot. So, but he's the founder of the Print Screen Festival in Haifa, a digital cultural festival which explores the themes between digital culture and cinema and the audiovisual arts. Maybe it's a little bit like Transmediale here in Germany. So, or the Republika. And Thomas Gegenhuber has a doctoral degree in business administration from the Johannes Kepler University in Linz, but he's also now lecturing at the Leuphania Universität in Lüneburg, and he is a fellow of the Austrian Academy of Science. And what they're studying about, they will tell you in a second. I think you also worked before with Ton Tapscott. Maybe that will be some remarks also. And I think, Lior, you are the first with the presentation. So here it comes. What happens when algorithm becomes your boss? Please.
Okay, so the purpose of this, a bit of a silly intro, a bit of a silly introduction, was to start by saying that when we talk about Uber, when we talk about these new platforms, specifically about Uber and the ride-hailing platforms, our point of departure, and that's the point of the departure also for my research conducted with Marijke Mühlmann, which is in the audience, and Ola Enfridsen, is that Uber has a problem controlling the crowds. Like, I have a challenge controlling you guys. You guys don't owe me anything. You could just stop and leave at any given second, right? But look how easy it was to manipulate you. Look how willing you were to participate. That's very kind of you. It was super risky. I even planted some people in the audience to participate just in case. You know, and I had lines, if you won't participate, and so on and so forth. But you did, which is very nice. And Uber has a similar challenge. Drivers are basically independent people, officially. This allows Uber to basically use them a bit and minimize labor costs. But it does mean that they can't always know if drivers will show up at a specific time and place. This is from Scheiber, who wrote about it in the New York Times. And this is the challenge, or the lack of control they're facing, right? This is the challenge, how to make them do what we want them to do, what Uber wants them to do in this case. And this is a story, a very interesting story from last year's in New York Times, that says that Uber is using psychological tricks to push its drivers' buttons. And now you can guess what kind of psychological tricks. Like saying something that will make them go to the next level, ante up, like in the world of games. The idea is that people want to participate. People want to gain stuff, and they hate losing stuff. So if we'll make them think about it, we'll be able to control their action and basically predict them better. So the whole thing, says Ellie Solomon, which is a driver for Uber and Lyft, the whole thing is like a video game. For instance, if you want to make it to 40, if you want to leave Uber in the middle of the day, make it to 40, they say. You're $6 away from making $40 in net earning. Are you sure you want to go offline? And you can be pretty sure that most people then say, I want to keep driving, right? Because this is so hard to click the go offline button after you see this. We are going to talk, not just me, but also Thomas today, about the subject of algorithmic management, management on platforms. The challenge, of course, is that we have smaller, relatively efficient companies, not with a lot of employees, but they need to govern a lot of employees specific, like, let's call them independent contractors. It's not clear, of course, if they're really employees or independent. That's the major question that maybe we will leave to the discussion. But what Uber is operating, all these tricks, all these control schemes, it's called algorithmic management. And that's the governance undertaken by software algorithms to control a multitude of workers whose task performance, in this case, to drive people from place to place, is central to the enterprise's effectiveness. And ride-hailing, like Uber does, is algorithmic management. And there was a nice paper by Rosenblatt and Stark 2 years ago that says that basically what Uber operates are information and power asymmetries. They know everything. The drivers know a very, very small part of the picture. They know where things are headed. They have the full picture, but the drivers are not. And not only that, they track drivers' behavior. They evaluate the performance, you know, those star ratings they receive and they get. And they automatically implement decisions. If drivers are acting badly, they could log them off the system immediately. They could cut them loose. That's almost not the case, right, with local, with jobs that we know, right? Because in jobs when we know, when we have a problem, when we have an issue, we have somebody to turn to. We have a boss to go. We have somebody to shout at. We have somebody to complain to. And here's where it's ironic, really. Uber really tracks the autonomous workers, the people who want to do work where they don't have a boss. The drivers are saying, you are your own boss. If you want, you work. If you don't want, you don't work. And how much hours do you do each day, we ask? It depends on you. Drivers can stop at any time. They decide how many hours to work. They pride themselves in being independent. They don't really identify highly with the company as we do with, like, local, I mean, traditional companies. And they have no direct human supervision. But then, not surprisingly, there are tensions forming up, right? The independent autonomous labor is almost ironically facing the most difficult control scheme ever, a company that knows everything about them, knows what they're doing at every time. They track their behavior, as I said, and they evaluate their performance, and they can fire them or quit, have them quit at any point of time. So the tensions are being formed around the issues of transparency. The Uber driver doesn't always know why is it being cut off? Why is it being logged out for now? Why doesn't he get jobs or doesn't get them when he feels or she feels they need to? And maybe also kind of complicated is that they work in isolation, in full isolation. They don't have colleagues, right? They are in their car with their passengers, but they don't have anybody to talk to. And if they reach some sort of crisis, if they do that, they need to email the company. They don't have nobody to talk to usually. There's no driver, human driver hotline, let's say. They need to talk with another algorithm, with an email system in this case. And I'll give you one example. Pool, you all guys know what Uber Pool is? So Pool is the shared route kind of, or a shared passenger experience. It's an example for what I call now the lack of transparency and control. And if you Google this, if you'll just look at what Google results when you look at Uber Pool, you will find this is a very common page. Uber Pool sucks. What should drivers expect from Uber Pool? Uber Pool is awful for drivers. Uber Pool is hated by everyone, basically. So the reason they hate Uber Pool, imagine this scenario, if you will. The reason they hate it is because once they accept, and usually they don't have any choice but to accept Uber Pool, they are losing even more control than they had from the get-go. Because Uber Pool means that they don't choose anymore. They are having, it's all okay? Okay. So they are basically starting to drive, and suddenly the computer, the algorithm is telling them, there's a passenger waiting for you in like 3 streets away. So the entire course is built automatically by this program. And people come and go like a bus, but it's a bus that supposedly you control, but you're not really. Once you are basically beginning this Uber Pool, you never know when all of the passengers are due. You never know when you are off the job, basically. You are stuck in this Uber Pool mode with the computer sending you places, sometimes very far away, and telling you exactly where and who to pick up. You don't have almost no choice in the matter. And if you decline those requests, basically you get your points reduced. And if you get enough points reduced, you get off, logged off the system. So they don't have a lot of choice in the matter. And I warn you, the next slide has a lot of text, but it's a really important citation from the forum we've been following. A driver said, they call it Uber Poo, by the way. Drivers like to refer them in the Uber forum to as Uber Poo. And he says, think about how crazy it is. We're driving to a set destination in the middle of a crowded city, using another app to navigate, and suddenly, wham, like George Michael, not the sports machines guy, everything changes through the Uber partner app while we drive, forcing us to rearrange everything, including the navigator, with one hand still on the wheel. Then it turns into a merry-go-round in which people are coming and departing in a non-sequential order. Surprise, it hasn't been banned by local officials, instead of being embraced as some sort of a shuttle service. So it's a very, it's also a bit of a dangerous situation. But what drivers are reporting to us, and we've been interviewing drivers in the last 2 years, both in New York and in London, what drivers report to us back is that they feel they are being treated more and more like robots. That they feel they don't have really control. They don't really understand why things are happening to them, why they are happening in this order. And if they want to complain, if they have something wrong, something done wrong to them, they have no one to talk to. So what do they do? How do drivers regain their control? How do they remain human in an age of algorithmic management? And that's exactly what we research. So the first things that we saw in the research that they're doing is that they're guessing or sense-making the system. They're making up stories, like the story we sometimes basically use in our culture, in our religion, to make sense of the world and its wonders. They don't understand why certain things are coming or why certain things are happening to them, so they make up stories about them. Here's a story, for instance. Let's say I do 70 rides in Lyft, and then I need 5 more to make a bonus. Altogether, normally, 5 rides can make me like an hour and a half to 2, But those are, you know, those last five rides take me like 7, 8, 10 hours, you know. That's because they don't want to give me that ride that fast, I guess. So here's an Uber driver, or a Lyft driver in this case, who's complaining that Lyft are knowingly prohibiting his drive, basically not letting him drive people because they don't want to pay them. That's the key kind of stories we see over and over again in the Uber forum. So those stories are being socially reinforced because drivers tend to agree with them and then suddenly develop even bigger stories. And we see the creation of stories, of myth, of urban legends. Now, I'm not saying it's all wrong, it's all lies. Of course it's not, but it's also probably not all true. But drivers have no choice. They don't know anybody to talk to. So they talk to each other, and since they don't know a lot of people in person, they talk to through a computer, through the Uber forum. And when those stories grow, and when those stories develop, then they act up on them. So what do? They resist the system. And we see sometimes actual attempts, if not to unionize, then to form strikes, then to form some sort of a resistance, of a protest against the Uber system. In this case, not taking Uber pool again. And you see in the forum, we, the partners, will oppose slavery, and we'll stand for our right until the last one of us. No pool for life. Who is with me? So it's a very much like Les Miserables, sort of like French Revolution, sort of like pathos. But they resist the system, and sometimes it even works for them in these incidents, sometimes in different cities. Some cities fight harder than others, some cities it's better than others, and sometimes it succeeds. It's, let's say, they reach limited success with some of their attempts. Here's another story about resistance. My mom, and this is from an Uber driver, my mom would make dinners with olives, but I wouldn't eat the olives. As I grew up, my mother would ask me if I liked olives. After years and years of telling her I will not eat olives, she has stopped her attempt to feed me olives. And this is a story that goes to show them that we should not give up, that we should always tell them what we are willing or not willing to do, to stay human and to fight for the rights, in this case, not to take Uber pool. So that's one option. Another option is switching the system. And one of the cities we've researched is New York. And New York has a lot of options. There's Uber, there's Lyft, there's Juno, who was bought by Gett, so there's Gett, there's Via. And drivers, basically, I don't know if you've ever experienced this, but drivers have multitude of phones. When you enter now, it looks almost like a cockpit in the plane because they have so many screens to look at, which is also a bit dangerous, but let's leave that point aside. They choose all the time. They are with their eyes on multiple platforms at once. And they say, I choose by favorite company. I've opened all these things, apps from different car hailing companies. I get Uber customer. And if on the way, Juno, which is in this case a favorite company of his, Juno also have that request. I cancel the Uber and I get Juno. So they get all calculative and such. Another driver says, we all know that these companies like to offer better incentives to drivers that miss some time. So if you log off Uber, Uber will say, hey, you forgot about us, how about we'll give you a bonus? So they start to be, again, very strategic about it. You drive Uber for 1 week, then Juno next, then Lyft third, and then they switch from Uber to Juno, and they start sharing these schemes of how to make it work financially for them. Which leads me to my next and I think last point, because the other action that they sometimes perform is gaming or tricking, which if you think about it, is there anything more human than trying to game and trick the systems? Robots are not usually trying to trick you or game you, but humans, and that's also a flaw, I guess, in some social relations, they try to trick and game you. So is it all fair in love and Uber? And there's a lot of attempts. Actually, our research got a lot of news because we quoted there a saying that sometimes drivers are trying to organize together to log off at once to increase surge. And of course, as newspaper and mass media goes, they turned it into this crazy story where it's done all the time. So it's not done all the time, but it's one option of gaming and tricking back the system. There's actually an app, I think now it's illegal, but there's an app for the drivers that lets you see the passenger app at the same time and gives you more tricking advice. Because here's the thing, you remember the lack of transparency? The driver is not supposed to look at the search prices or the search situation from the passenger app. So they're trying to coordinate this. They're trying to see both the passenger view and their own view to see where it makes the most financial sense. And it's actually not so uncommon that the driver will ask you while driving if you can tell him what's the situation from your side as a passenger, because he can see how much or where it's more profitable to go in some cases. And there's another case, I tell them this, the other drivers say, I'm going to drop you off and end the trip. And this is sort of illegal, but they do it sometimes. Then I drop them off and I cancel so they can't rate me. So if they have a customer which they feel will rate them poorly, they basically drop them and cancel so quickly so they won't get a complaint. Of course, sometimes they do get a complaint, but that's another sort of incident that we have seen in the forums. And again, this looks like very malicious, very maybe bad example of a behavior, of a driver behavior. But again, look at it from their point of view. They are facing the more inhumane, and I'm not saying inhumane like human rights violation, but inhumane in the sense they are being in isolation without transparency, they are being treated like robots. So I say that they are gaming and tricking the system, not just because of financial gain. That's the easy answer. They are also doing this because that makes them feel human again in the face of robotic and algorithmic management. So this is the model in total. And again, independent autonomous labor meets the most controlled management ever, algorithmic management, and tensions are formed. And basically the result is that they are guessing the system, they are starting to develop these myths and stories, and then they end up resisting switching or gaming the system. Not always. Most people are very compliant, like you were with the claps, but some people do rebel against it. So some concluding thoughts. Is it really the year of the driver? Uber has mentioned that 2017 was the year of the driver. You know, they had a lot of trouble in the last year or two, regulation, sexual harassment, you name it. But they said, we are going to invest in the driver. And it's not really clear that they've done so. Actually, it's not really clear what this current situation with drivers. Recently, a federal court in the US said they are not employees. But now, I think just today in California, there was another ruling, again, not federal, only in California, that they might, that will probably paved the way for them to be employees. And this fight is very, very, very close from finish line. So it's really not clear. Can we build a sustainable business model in which we share consultancy drivers like human? I know a lot of the sessions here, we can work it out, are going to deal exactly with this question. I can tell you one tip. Juno does have a human customer service. And while it's really hard to maintain it, that is exactly what is needed to give them the feeling that they are human again. And we've interviewed Juno drivers. Juno was now bought by Gett, but back then Juno. And they said the fact that we can talk to a human, even if it doesn't help us, if she or he doesn't help us immediately, the fact that we talk to human makes all the difference. So this is a reassuring thought I'd like to end with and pass it to Thomas, who will give the perspective of how to make more participatory platforms that really treat workers fairly. The reassuring thought is that in this age, in the face of automation, where it seems like the road is paved to go to autonomous cars, drivers, while we still need them, while we still drive, drivers will find creative ways to use the same technology to regain their sense of control and allow themselves to exercise their own agency, to be human again. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Lior. Good afternoon also from my side. My name is Thomas Gegenhuber. I'm presenting research here today that I conducted with Markus Elmer and Claudia Schaeber. And let's just dive right in. As many platforms see themselves as marketplaces or as a service provider, And as Lior vividly demonstrated to you, platforms such as Uber care little for the human worker, let alone give them an say on how to improve the working condition. So what do workers do in the case of Uber? They create workarounds around algorithms and wherever possible, and they use forums such as Uber People to exchange knowledge about best practices. Mechanical Turk, which is the digital assembly line for outsourcing microtasks, is very similar in that regards. Mechanical Turk sees itself as a marketplace. The platform does hardly offer any instruments for workers to issue complaints. Workers simply do not get heard on this platform. So when MTurkers meet again in outside communities to exchange knowledge, for instance, they go on these forums like Turker Hub or MTurk Crowd or Turker Nation, and they go about reporting shady employers on the platform. So even when the platform governance and the algorithms are to the disadvantage of crowd workers, workers attempt to make the best out of it. But the question is this really how labor relations should look like in a digital economy? And it seems like those outside communities, as useful as they are, they do a lot of things that the platform should do in the first place. So this was the starting point for our research, and we were intrigued whether all platforms organize labor relations like Uber or Mechanical Turk. We took the stance that platforms are not just marketplaces, platforms are employers. So that's brings us to our research questions. We wondered whether and how do platforms voluntarily implement participation instruments for crowd workers. The idea is that worker participation influences the way how work is organized. And I think we need to define what do we mean by worker participation. By participation, we mean that a platform voluntarily puts in place instruments to enable workers to raise their voice, to increase their autonomy, to improve their working condition, or to influence a platform's decision-making. And in this line of thinking, it's really an employer does that voluntarily. And literature on worker participation in offline context shows that increased worker participation is associated with improved efficiency, improved productivity, and also results in a better worker climate. And the question is, why do employers do that? One reason could be, I as an employer, I care about creating a better workplace. And of course, another reason could be workers or employers just simply want to reap the functional benefits associated with participation. And I want to highlight that this voluntarily worker participation is different from a union-based system, so organizing labor relations about unions, because if you organize as a union, in general, you have certain legally binding rights, and you have instruments at your disposal to formally influence the decision-making of an organization. But in our study, we really focus on voluntarily implementing instruments for worker participation. We examined six crowdsourcing platforms that are located in Germany. Just briefly to explain them, the first one is Yoboto, which is a platform for innovation and sophisticated designs, where corporations come in touch with designers. Content is a platform for clients who seek content for blogs or for online shops, and they're connected with a crowd of writers. Design and Lesson is basically a digital marketplace for creative design based on a contest model. Clickworker is more like Mechanical Turk. App Chopper is a platform where clients send basically the crowd on a scavenger hunt in the physical world for marketing reasons, and TestBirds finally is a platform where the crowd scrutinizes products on behalf of a client. So how did we conduct this research? So for one, we conducted participant observation, so we logged on the platforms, we actually did the tasks the platform asked us to do, and for another we made document analysis, so we looked at things like an FAQ and other official documents. In our study, we identified two critical dimensions for organizing participation. The first dimension is the participation mode. By participation mode, we need to look at how does a platform's interface or infrastructure is enabling workers to participate. The second dimension, participation content, is really about in what areas workers can actually participate. And I want to start with the participation mode and move you through the four modes that we identified. The first and most basic mode, and relates to what Leah said before, is informing. Informing is, does a platform provide transparent information about what is going on? And that aids crowd workers in the decision whether and how to work, which in turn increases a crowd worker's autonomy. An example here is from the platform content. They, as you can see here, without going into detail, they provide you a detail list, how you, much you earn for what. And they also provide, you can see that here, a tool that enables you as a crowd worker to see if I spend so much time and if I write that fast, how much I would approximately earn. And I'm not saying this wage calculation tool is perfect, but I think this is in stark difference to other platforms, for example, contest platforms such as the 99 Designs or the example Design and Lesson that I mentioned before, because in a contest model, a lot of people submit their designs and only one or a few win in the design, so a lot of people don't get paid. And these platforms have tons of data available, but they give workers no information about the actual winning chance. But given the data they have, it would be rather easy to provide a tool that gives workers a realistic assessment of the winning chances on such a platform. The second mode is reporting. Reporting means that an organization or a platform opens up an individual channel for a crowd worker to harness the feedback from a crowd worker, or that the crowd worker can initiate or raise an issue on their own. Examples here is a lot of platforms we observed have a contact form. Some platforms have the opportunity to rate your employer, so that's an instrument to weed out shady employers and clients. And some platforms, more or less regularly, or when an issue emerged, survey their community members. And the idea of the ratings and surveys is that, of course, we pool those judgments from the crowd workers. And in our research, we tested the contact forms, and the platforms actually did answer. They did vary in their quality, but in contrast to Uber, as Leo mentioned, we actually got pretty clearly an answer for a human. And again, this is really different from Uber. In Uber, you talk to a machine, and here we have a contact form. Depending on how much they really react to your response, at least it's a human response. The third mode is dialoguing, where the platform engages in a publicly accessible conversation with the crowd, either by proactively turning to the crowd and asking for feedback, or crowd workers bringing up issues on their own. What instruments do facilitate dialoguing? Dialoguing is enabled through forums or discussion boards. And here's an example of the platform Jovoto, which until recently mostly used a contest model for its design projects. And in these contests, a huge part of the prize money was distributed through a community voting. So the community itself could decide who in the community and who of the participants should receive prizes. And to improve the algorithm and how the prizes are distributed, Jovoto engaged in a dialogue with its community and actually used the input from the community to improve the algorithm. The fourth mode, how we can organize worker participation, is including. By including, we mean that a platform asks users, for instance, through a vote in a poll, to include crowd workers in actual decision-making. So in contrast to the other participation modes, voting implies some form of accountability. That means that the platform puts in place the course of action that the majority of the crowd decides upon. And here's an example from the platform Design and Lesson, and they use a voting to determine a designer or a winning design of the month, and the winner receives a small prize. And I think you already see, like, if you think about this form of inclusion, you get the sense this is more about a community engagement tool and not really about participation. And that example just demonstrates, if you think of participation, we not only need to think how it happens, but also in what areas those participation instruments are used. And that brings me to the next dimension of participation content. The first dimension encompasses whether workers can use participation tool to improve their work conditions within the setup of the platform. And an example for this is the platform providing transparent information about the nature of work and how it's organized, or enabling crowd workers to report issues such as, hey, there is a bug, or there's a missing payment, and we're going to react to that. The second dimension is about participating in how work is actually organized, which means crowd workers participate in changing the platform setup in which their work takes place. And an example from the platform content, on this platform's employers rate the quality of the work of the crowd, and that, of course, impacts the amount of the payment. And workers complained about the system, so content surveyed the crowd whether the evaluation system is appropriate, and discussed with the crowd whether it's necessary to improve the system. And also the example from before, from Jovoto I showed you, is an example how dialoguing could be used to change the setup and let workers participate on how rewards are distributed. The third dimension, the most radical dimension, most substantial dimension is whether platforms enable workers to shape the overall strategic direction of the firm. So what path, what business model a firm deploys, of course, has an impact on how work is organized and how the people get paid. And to be frank, in our study, we did find no example where workers participate in this kind of dimension. And the only example we could think of at the moment is the platform experiment Daimo, which is a Stanford platform, which is also a platform for microtasks. And on this platform, a team of workers, employers, and a researcher decides upon the overall direction of this platform. So if we make an assessment combining those two dimensions, we conclude that actually worker participation matters on the platform that we investigated. But if we look at more closely, if we think about the participation mode, we find that informing is kind of okay. Reporting tools are used quite strongly, although personally I would like to see more platforms having tools where the crowd workers evaluate the clients or the employers. Some platforms use dialoguing, and including basically hardly matters. In terms of content, most of worker participation occurs within the platform setup. So in some rare instances, platforms also discuss with the crowd how to change the overall platform setup and how the work is organized. And the third dimension impacting the direction is non-existent. And we can think about, of course, like if you have a forum for dialoguing or reporting, of course you could, as a crowd member, say, I'm going to use that to change the setup or bring up issues of direction. But our impression is, when we observe this platform, that this is not the case. There could be several reasons for that. Either crowd workers are not willing to speak up, or there's simply no interest. And that's, of course, an issue for my research. So let me briefly conclude. In contrast to marketplaces such as Amturk or Uber, worker participation plays a role in the case of Germany-based crowdsourcing platforms. Platforms use several tools, but overall concentrate on issues how to better organize work within the platform set up by the platform. So I think there's still much work to do. And certainly also a privately owned platform could think about, could we elect crowd worker representatives, or, you know, should we think about, could we unionize the workers? But I think it's also worth remembering that limits of participation occur due to the governance and ownership structure of the platforms. If platforms are privately owned and they have venture capital, the venture capitalist enforces a platform to scale as quickly as possible, so that leaves not sufficient resources to think about worker participation. And I think those limits show that, again, if we think about the work of Treber Scholz and also a session later on today from the Hans-Böckler Stiftung, we need to think more about common-based models and cooperatives as alternatives. And I think that means that, and I concur with Lear, that if we have more worker participation on privately owned platforms, more unionization and comment-based alternatives, and more competition among the platforms, it could actually be that the future is going to be brighter than we expect. Thank you.
Okay, so we have a few minutes for a discussion and Q&A with you. We don't really see you, but we'll do our best. Maybe I'll start with a question for you, Thomas. And I know I'm going to do a very risky thing because I'm asking you a question that I'm not sure I can answer myself about my own research, but maybe you have a better answer. And this is, first, how sincere, like you've been researching participation, how sincere do you think these participation schemes, these participation attempts are by these companies? Do you think they are like a cover to actually allow continue using workers and paying them less by making them feel they are more involved? Because we know that when people are involved, they're willing to do a lot of stuff for low money. That's how volunteering works, right? So I was just wondering about that.
I mean, we know that from human relations school, if you let people think about the workplace and they feel they can open up, then they feel better. I think it varies. I think some platforms which have a culture or are grounded in the work process on a creative community, I think they're more inclined to care about these issues because they're getting different kind of crowd. If you have something like as Mechanical Turk or ClickWorker, this issue might just not matter as much. But I think what you showed before, like this idea of switching between different platforms, because if we have more competition between the platforms, at least if they don't really care about creating a better workplace, they might just force to care about participation because they're competing over the workers. And I think Uber gets pressure and suddenly they start to change. And I think that might be part of the solution.
I have a question. I've been on the conference about crowd and cloud working from the big German union last week, IG Metall. And that was quite interesting to see. Well, of course, it was about the political union framework of cloud and crowd working. But according to your subject, the idea was, can an algorithm represent other values than they represent now? So how can we put other values or other ways of working into the algorithm? So the algorithm can help us to have a new common ground and not, a neoliberal algorithm.
So let's take maybe the notion of transparency, because I know a lot of you are involved in transparency-related activism. Algorithms are supposed to be more ideal, not sure that are fully ideal, to the notion of transparency, right? Because when it's not, when there's rules, when there's an algorithm, when there's a stated language that says exactly how things work, it was supposed to be relatively easy to make it transparent. Now, of course, I'm not naive. There's business on the other side that makes it very non-transparent, very strategic, very competitive. And on the other hand, we have, and I think Dana discussed this morning with the keynote, we have AI, and we have algorithms that are formed, and then companies, they don't know exactly what's going on beyond the algorithm because there's some randomness to it, some complex statistics. But when we speak about values in algorithm, I think, and I've, I studied my computer science degree almost over 20 years ago. I remember that being active in that field and, as an activist / young computer scientist, I was thrilled of the possibility that I have everything documented. Everything is written somewhere. So I think those values, the value of transparency is one example. You know what? Another value, I'll say it really quickly, is egalitarianness or equalness, right? The system is supposed to be egalitarian, to be equal and open to everyone. Everyone has a voice. Everyone is mediated via an avatar, so people can also make up their own identity. And I think in some of these platforms, you are not being fully identified. So it's also a place of freedom, supposedly a place of egalitarianness, but then we see in reality it's not always the case. Sometimes these biases come back to haunt us from various conditions. But I still think algorithms could also be ideal in those senses if they will be designed right.
And to add to that, I think the important thing about algorithms is they're always infused values, and ideas and decisions are infused into algorithms. So what I like to see on those crowdsourcing platforms or crowdworking or Uber, whatever you want to call them, or sharing economy platforms, is that they make their assumptions transparent on what's the basic idea also behind these algorithms, because we cannot expect that as soon as it's transparent that people also going to interpret the information correctly, but they should be open about what are the basic working assumptions and explain in a plain FAQ language how is work assigned. Yeah, and they should make this available.
There's a book, a really nice booklet, almost like a short book by Douglas Rushkoff, the media theorist, called Code or Be Coded. And it's a really nice sort of manifesto about this, about the fact that we do need to be more, you know, in terms of literacy, we need to orient ourselves around code, be more comfortable with that concept in general in order to not be manipulated that much.
More questions?
Be the brave first question or second question.
Hello, my name is Anya. Thank you for both your talks. I was wondering, you were both focusing on situations where the platform actually serves workers or provides workers to the platform, whichever way you see it. Would you think the same models are transferable to situations where it's just users of a platform? I mean, the whole social media universe basically is comparable in a way because we provide not our ability to work, but other bits and pieces to the platform.
So generally, yes. I think we see a similar experience to the one I portrayed in Facebook, where you as a customer feel that you have nobody to talk to. I don't know how many of you have ever experienced troubles with Facebook. Your page has disappeared, maybe your content was censored. And then what can you do, really? They don't really care about you. They care about who pays them actual money. And it's supposedly a smart, efficient company. So they also don't have these fleet of employees they can employ to answer every one of the billion customers' questions, right? So I think also us as a customer, consumer, maybe prosumer, user who generates content, whatever you like to call it, we also experience that we feel like we are part of Facebook algorithm in a way. We are part of the robotic system that Facebook built to, you know, socially construct our world in a way.
I think that's a good answer.
You know what? So maybe one more anecdote about that. There's the subject of content moderation, which I'm also very interested in. And now Facebook, which again strive to be this very efficient company, suddenly employs, and again, I'm not sure if it's like, it's not fully employees, it's contractors again, content moderators by the thousands. Suddenly they realize that there are tasks that they need human eyes for, and that they need multitudes of workers for them. So for those content moderators, again, another subject, another sort of employees by social media that are being treated kind of similar to Uber drivers.
And I think what I like to add to that is, like, we could maybe make the hypothesis that as soon as platforms reach a critical threshold and are really gone really, really big, they run into problems where algorithm management is just not sufficient and they need to put in place some human mechanisms to resolve issues.
Okay,
how do you balance, do we have an idea how to balance the egalitarian way of the community finding the values which are put into the algorithm and lawmaking, which giving a clear framework, like saying, you are a platform, you have to provide services, social services to your workers. We have 1.1 million cloud workers in Germany. unorganized, individualized, and how do you balance law between law and egalitarian way of community finding?
Or
do we need more law?
Yeah, I mean, we certainly need more regulation in the digital world. And I think, and it was mentioned also before in the talks today, that actually we could be at the forefront of not just letting loose everyone, but think about what are basic regulations every platform needs. What I just find fascinating in our cases is it's really out, like in Uber, outside communities doing just a lot of works that the platforms do. And you don't, which is still great that they do it, but we could have regulations saying certain things like there should be a tool for reporting shady employers. We could enforce regulations like that. And it would help the people to create better working conditions.
Yeah, and I want to make the case for this participation approach. So before researching Uber, my PhD was mostly about content websites. I've been looking at Last.fm, which are almost, you know, rest in peace Last.fm, if you know the music service, back then in the, like a decade ago, and YouTube. And I've been looking at the participation or the way they encourage participation over those platforms. And I noticed that people who participate tend to also value, in terms of money, in terms of economics, they value the website more. So I try to make a case that community-based business models or community-based participation, and I'm trying not to be too cynical here, they're not just good ethically, they are making good business. But when I chose this as the point of my thesis, my mind was about that I sort of hated ads and ad business models that I know a lot of other sessions here are talking about them because I, you know, we all know how exploitive they are. And I know that participation could be also exploitive, as we said. Participation could lead to also force, you know, we did some manipulation tricks. This is also something that looks participatory but really is manipulative in a way. But I still think that A, we need to look at law, you know, law should be our fallback option. We need to really strive for more participatory approaches, but at the same time, we need to make sure that we are educated enough with all this persuasion mechanism and participatory attempts and try to look at very, you know, straight level. Try to look at it like for the value that it is, so we will not be manipulated in another way. It's, you know, this equation of either being manipulated or being without any privacy. It doesn't necessarily need to be that way. Uber model is also being, you know, takes the worst of two evils. You are being tracked all the time and you are being manipulated in many ways. And I feel the first step in order to overcome this is awareness. And, you know, being in sessions like this in Republica is basically a good step forward.
And just to add to that, is there's actually research that once workers or the crowd identifies with a certain brand or an employer, their judgments about what's justified or not changes. So if I identify more, I'm more willing to, you know, give them a platform the benefit of the doubt or not care as much about the decision. So that would be added to that. There's definitely this area for misuse. I think.
Well, if they're all public questions answered, I'm sure you will be here maybe for some more private questions, another 5 minutes. On the side of the stage or at the door. Then I have to say thank you, Lior. Thank you, Thomas,
for your
inspiring talk. I think this subject will continue being a subject of the Republica the next years. And thank you for your inspiration.
Thank you.
And your support. And just for your information, we have